Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. My guest on this episode is Richard O'Leary of Culture Tech. I met Richard at a family office conference earlier this year, and I was absolutely fascinated at the story he had to tell about the art world and what turns out to be a bewildering set of copyright / IP challenges that owners, collectors, and particularly creators of art face. It's a world I knew nothing about. Like many problems today, the difficulties are analog in nature and the solutions look decidedly digital. So I wanted to bring Richard onto the show to discuss what is a little known part of the world that sits at the intersection of past and future, spreadsheets and blockchain, all kinds of things. So please enjoy my conversation with Richard O'Leary. Richard, thanks for joining me. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Grant. Thrilled to join you, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, I had to invite you. You and I crossed paths in Montana back in, I guess it was May, which seems a lifetime ago now. And we were there for an event and got chatting. And what you're doing was something that I knew nothing about. I was completely blindsided by what you're doing. I just found the whole thing so fascinating. So I'm really pleased that we found some time to talk about it because as blindsided as I was and as fascinating as I found it, I'm hoping that a lot of people will feel the same way. So as a lead up to that, perhaps if you wouldn't mind, perhaps you could give people a little bit of your background. Because again, it's different from what you're doing now, but I think it's incredibly complementary and it's quite the story.
Well, thank you, Grant. So yes, my background is from the marketing services, what's now called the marketing services industry, but it's really coming out of agencies. I started my career in the WPP world and then shifted over to Interpublic Group somewhere along the line. And it really was a front row seat to the digitization of everything from a marketing perspective. And obviously everything in the world has gone that way. And in particular, I looked after a community of our global accounts for a while, which include companies like MasterCard and L'Oreal and General Motors and Coca-Cola and, you know, big companies all really wrestling with how to content start to be developed, managed, and distributed in different ways in the digital world. So I became, frankly, quite interested and intrigued, sort of became a student of how content is managed largely in cloud-based computer software platforms. And quite honestly, I bumped into what we'll talk about in a minute, which is a marketplace for licensing in the art world that I kind of knew a little bit about because in the agency world, we are responsible for clients securing rights to everything that they're using. So it wasn't that I was unaware, but as we'll come on to in a second, this has become a really interesting potential, actually disabled marketplace that we at Culture Tech are enabling. So I think, yeah, for my background, I've always loved working with creative people. I don't consider myself a creative person per se. I'm humbled at working with people who create. And what I discovered is the new creators are coders, the people that really are both conceptualizing new ways of working and doing things and accessing things, have coding backgrounds or actually are doing the coding themselves. And I wanted to work with those people. So I was looking pretty fervently for an opportunity to put together a team of people that are doing that to create something that has never been created before. So, and ideally in a creative field, which obviously, you know, art ticks that box. So
yeah, for sure. So before we get onto that, what you're doing there with Culture Tech, let's talk a little bit about the explosion in content from that marketing advertising perspective, because it's been an extraordinary thing to watch, and it kind of slow burn. And then really over the last kind of 10 years, I guess, we've seen as consumers, certainly you probably got a head start on that from the creative side, but we've seen as consumers just this explosion of content. So what was that like going from the kind of pre-YouTube, TikTok, Instagram type content? How did that transition look from the inside of that industry?
Well, I think in some ways it replicated what happened in advertising when television, frankly, as historic as that may sound, some of the transformation was similar. And a lot of what happens, I've always believed in the agency business, both agencies and our clients are inveterate trend watchers and trendsetters in the best sense of the word. And what I think we always have to deal with at the end of the day is, what are consumers thinking? What are they feeling? And how do they, as a consequence, behave? And so in some ways, you really just, you follow the breadcrumbs. And what first started to happen in dialogue with our clients was, what's my digital strategy, is what we would hear. Often, as somebody like you, Grant, would, you sort of look at people you're working with and say, what do you mean by that? Like, what is a digital strategy? And because it was new. And quickly, I can't put a time limit on it, but very quickly, the conversation changed from not what is my digital strategy, but what is my content strategy? And that, to me, became the real point of transition, where everybody, to your observation, everybody is now producing content. And in some ways, that can be not negative, but it can be hard to reconcile, hard to manage. And on the other, it's a huge opportunity for lots of companies to become more creative, engage their consumers in ways that add value to the experience of their product or their store or whatever business they're in. And so, yes, it changed, obviously, the requirement that was put on creative people, because, you know, while we used to be really producing one-way communications, well, we're now doing what you do, which is we become storytellers and you find different ways to tell stories. And honestly, while I'm not directly in the agency business anymore, there's never been a better time, I think, to be in the agency business or marketing on the client side, because you are telling stories. And that's inherently an interesting way to make a living, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think the importance of stories is so misunderstood and vastly underappreciated, that we're all connected by stories. To me, that's the foundation of society and even mankind. If we didn't have stories, I just don't know how we relate to each other. So I'm always fascinated at that industry, how these people are so gifted in taking an idea and a message and creating a story around it that will sell a product, will sell an idea in 20 seconds or in one picture on a billboard. It's just such a fascinating space to be in.
It's true. And, you know, the other thing that it forced, and it still continues to do, I think, with every organization, even if they're a new company with a new product, is it's no longer just about what benefit are you providing in the world, what does your product actually do for people, but what's your mission and your broader purpose. And I know people talk about that, but I do think, from working with major Fortune 500 companies down to small startups like us, there is a real, I think, wholesome, honest buy-in to the fact that you have to have a purpose beyond whatever it is you're selling. And creating content really forces that decision. Like, who are we? Why do we exist? Of course, we're here to make money. We have a unique selling proposition. We have a unique place in the market, whatever that is, all a given. But what's our broader purpose in life? And I'm struck, by the way, I noticed this recently in just walking around Greenwich Village, that you walk into a lot of these new retail establishments of products you've really never heard of. And it really hits you right in the face that whatever they believe their noble purpose is written all over the wall. And it can get a little much, to be honest, but I think it's emblematic of the fact that companies have to take seriously how they're servicing the broader community in the broader world. And that's where storytelling becomes essential. It's critical to that process.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Well, let's get on to the meat of the conversation, talk about culture tech, because as I said, it's such a fascinating idea. And I think the best way to do this is just to walk through your journey of understanding this opportunity, explaining perhaps what it is, and then explaining how culture tech is going about it, because I'm going to have so many questions along the way, just as I did when we first talked about this. But if we're going to tell a story, it seems to make sense to start at the beginning.
Well, you know, it's funny, so I'm going to actually contradict you and start at the end.
All right, that's fine. Hey, it's your story.
What is it in a? Is it a prologue?
I'll get the subtitles that just say 5 years earlier, like they do in all the movies when they stop the end.
Exactly, exactly. But what's interesting, literally, from the current moment, the arrival and acceleration of artificial intelligence is beginning to shine a light on what we've been working on at Culture Tech, which I'll describe, for a couple of years now. And in fact, it made the front page New York Times headlines just this past Sunday that copyright protected content, art images, photography, stories, videos, but art in particular, has tremendous untapped value. And I'm not talking about what we know is the objects of art themselves, but it's copyright protected content, which is lots and lots, billions and billions of images out there of objects that have rights attached to them. And we estimate the addressable audience for the exchange of rights for images of art to be close to $6 billion and growing. That's a global number. And obviously will grow exponentially. And right now, what happens is anybody that needs to use an image of an art object has to get permission. In the main, there's what's called open access art, which is art that's not under copyright, that's now in the public domain. But even then, our research with a lot of digital developers, social media managers, UX designers, they don't want to touch in any of their work a cultural heritage or an art object because there's such perceived value in the creation of it that they're afraid if they use it, somebody's going to say, oh, I have a right to that. You can't use it. So the whole AI discussion now in the creative community has become, hey, wait a minute. I have a right to that. And even though on the one hand, this means protecting rights becomes even more important in a artificial intelligence world. And on the other, it means that the full realization of artificial intelligence, which is incredible, and obviously we're all fascinated by it and watching both the good and the bad in it. But the promise of AI doesn't really become real in the art world without connected data, meaning all of this information out there about who owns a particular right to an image of an object. Where is the object itself? Where has it moved from and to? And by the way, there are, I think I mentioned this when we were together, any, like music, any one art object may have multiple rights holders. It could be the estate of the artist. It could be heirs. It could be the photographer that took a picture. It could be the gallery that originally sold the object. And so all of that information in a digital world becomes super important to collect and to share. And so really the Culture Tech vision is simply this. Phase one of our business is to create software that allows all those people out there today at museums, at art galleries, at auction houses, at publishing houses, at newspapers, at online art companies, to have an easier, more fluid way of automating the process of licensing, permitting and asking for permission from owners all in one application. And what happens, as you know, as we all know, when people start using data entry management software that requires them to do this because they're doing it manually already, so automating it, it means that all that data is coming in to a shared place that has real value for a lot of people. And so the way we look at it is this is a disabled market right now where lots of people are manually asking for its faxes, believe it or not, it's spreadsheets, it's stuff like this, which, you know, isn't surprising because we've seen that in a lot of sectors of business and enterprise. So it's a disabled market in that no one has yet built until us a data entry management system to allow people to automate the royalty payments between all these parties. But again, the capturing of all that data is where it becomes really interesting because eventually to be able for anybody, you or me, to be able to discover where an art object is, who has the rights to use it, can I download it, can I get a high-res image of it, can I use it somewhere, how can I use it, that isn't known, that isn't established. And so as a consequence, there's pent-up demand. We did an interesting piece of research when we started Culture Tech, again, with people that I call the creative web community that really wrestle with content and need content every day. As a marketing person, I was stunned to see a 92% demand rate, meaning 92% of a pretty significant panel study that we did, 90% of these users said, I would love to use an image of an important art object if I could get a written permission. And that written permission is a ticket or a reservation, just like it is on OpenTable or Mind and Body or any platform that people are using. And so that's what my team gets excited about, is taking what is best practices in software and applying it to this process. So that's a little bit of the beginning of the overview anyway.
Right, right. So let's walk through this, because again, none of this stuff had occurred to me when we sat down and talked back in May. It just hadn't occurred to me. So if you can do now, as you did then, walk through where all these gaps are in the process, where all the rights are attached, because as I said, it just blew my mind, the number of places and ways and people that have claims on this stuff and how completely disorganized the entire process is. I'm just amazed by it, considering a lot of it comes from a publishing world where you would think that that stuff is pretty set.
Well, it starts with copyright law. Copyright law, if you go look the history of it, it was started in the UK. I believe it was Queen Mary. I may have the Queen wrong. Like a lot of things in the cultural world, it was really pioneered in the UK. And the idea was very simply to allow creators to claim a right to the use of a creation up until a certain time when it naturally should go out into the world. So whether it's Pygmalion that then became My Fair Lady, there is analog in other spaces of creativity. So with art, it starts with a creator has a right to the reproduction of his or her work. Interestingly, what most people don't understand, I didn't, is that an owner of an object doesn't have that right. And most typically, the owner of an art object, you know, you have art in your house and you think, well, that's mine, I own that. But actually, the law protects the creator. And so if you start with that reality, and then you couple that with the fact that art objects are not stationary, right? They move. They move from collection to collection. They move from museum to museum, exhibition to exhibition. There's a lot of movement. And unlike other things that move in the world, like humans, like us, we have a trail of healthcare records for each of us that in order to care for ourselves, our doctors, our hospitals have to have records. And that's a massive, massive industry. And so here, as things move and the law governs the use of an image of an art object, there hasn't been any tracking. So you might ask, well, why is that? And a lot of it has to do, we think, with two things. One, the internet has, like everything, has changed the reality. It was fine for a long time as art moved around. Images of it were used for exhibitions and trading between museums. So it was kind of an easier world to navigate. But now all of a sudden you have catalog resumes online for artists. You have exhibitions online. You have museums online, essentially. And that changes the requirement for managing that process. It makes it a very, frankly, it's highly nuanced because the way a particular image is used, where it's used, how it's used, based on who has the rights to it, becomes a pretty complex workflow, what people in enterprise software call a workflow. And so we really had to go in and deeply understand that workflow, emulate it in a software product. And we did that with just a little over 65, mostly because we're US-based at the moment, mostly US museums, but it's a process is the same pretty much around the world. And what we did is we designed first a prototype with them, for them, tested it. We now have spent the last year building it. And it's what it's really doing is a lot of what you're talking about. It's managing the information that governs that ownership. And it allows, in a much more fluid and speedy way, it allows a transaction to happen. What's especially interesting about the sort of movement around and the transactions of a license is right now, because it's so difficult, there's a real bottleneck. So if you ask most museums, even I think some of the auction houses we've started to talk to, it isn't very easy to do this. So in many cases, art object images just aren't being used. They're not out there. They're not necessarily accessible. And if you wanted to go online and search where a particular, let's say, famous piece of art, you have a piece of art you like, as a consequence, it's very hard to find out where exactly is it in the world. Where has it gone from and to, and how can I learn about it? And moreover, how can I actually download a high resolution image of it and actually use it? And in our current world, that just doesn't seem right. I mean, art is the very record of human achievement, really, and it should be accessible to everyone. And while it's accessible in the object form itself to really only a tiny percentage of people who can afford to buy a really important, valuable piece of art. So this is really also about democratizing access, for sure, which I'm sure I'm way off the question, sir. But
No. It's so fascinating. So let's walk through an example, something like, I don't know, let's say Van Gogh's Sunflowers. Obviously, painted by Van Gogh. If I was any good at this, I'd know exactly when he was born and when he died, but I could pick him out of a lineup of artists. But the creation of that painting, it's in someone's collection now, I'm sure. It must have gone through 50 hands between when it was painted and now, I'm sure. So walk us through the life of a painting like that and all the places along the way where they get these claims on IP from it, because this stuff just blew my mind.
Let's take that example. At some point, a picture was taken, and that could have been for a catalog or when a buyer bought it, maybe not long ago after Van Gogh painted it, but more recently. And the minute that happened, the estate can claim a right, the estate meaning the Van Gogh estate, or if it's a living artist, the artist, him or herself, they have a right to the image of that. That image may then, because it was taken by a photographer, that photographer may also have a right to that. So let's say that image ends up in a catalog somewhere. I always say to people, go to the back of an art book, and there are usually 30 pages of citations of owners of the images that you're looking at in the book. So that's the analog example, is in order for that photograph that photographer took, all of a sudden you have two claims. You have the photographer's claim to that photograph, and you have the estate's claim to that photograph. Now that photograph starts floating around in the internet world. How many photographs have there been of that artwork? And what we discovered pretty quickly is that the central governing body of this, if you will, is museums. Museums are the experts because they are by nature data keepers, librarians, curators that have the knowledge, the expertise, not just of the art and the artist, but of managing their collections. So what we really have done is we've jumped in and become as close and friendly with collection managers in institutions. The companies that manage that data for museums are our friends, the digital asset management companies, which actually manage the digital assets within a museum. So we've really tried, to your point, we've really tried to go in and look at all of those use cases of where is that image, who has a right to it, and that's all recorded. Those records may not be perfect, and people at museums will acknowledge that, which is all the more reason why you create a data entry management software system where that information can now start to be logged. It can be updated as the image moves around from exhibition to exhibition. So to complete the answer to your question, now let's say that particular sunflower painting is now going to be in a different exhibition, which is often happens. I was just looking at the Georgia O'Keeffe exhibition at MoMA, which is beautiful. Everybody should see it. She's an amazing artist. And you walk around that exhibition, and a lot of those paintings are from either private collections or other museums. And so then all of a sudden, the object moves. So an image is going to be used. It's going to be used in the catalog. It's going to be used on a coffee cup, on a calendar, on whatever. So that permission has to be secured. And so to have a shared log of who owns the rights is a really, really valuable thing for people. So we're really starting with a body of people who are managing this every day. And not surprisingly, they are digital native people. They're young people who really understand art. And they're populated, tens of thousands of them around the world, in these institutions that really care deeply, and the philanthropists that support these organizations really care deeply about the works and therefore getting the works out into the world. It's important to remember that the mission, the role of a museum is access. Right now, the secret inside the walls of a lot of these organizations is they have a lot of difficulty in a digital world with access. And a big part of it is this. Big part of it is that it's hard to be able to manage permissions. It's hard to have the information in every case. A great example is we'll talk to a licensing manager and say, well, what do you do when you start to mount an exhibition? What often happens is after 2 years of curators and experts putting an exhibition together, somebody in the organization is handed a pile of pictures that have been grabbed from the web on the objects in the collection and told, go secure rights. And you ask them, how do they do that? And they go, frantically Google. That's not necessary. And so a lot of them have said to us when we came along to inquire and to ask about their workflow and get their help, they said to us, where have you been? Which is always nice to hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. So the owner of a piece essentially has ownership, but basically no rights. They don't have any rights to the piece.
And to be honest, and this gets into a philosophical question, I think, about art collecting, about which I also don't know a lot, but I'm learning. Most collectors, they may want it to be out in the world. They don't necessarily want their name on it for obvious reasons. And so it's actually the owners themselves of objects aren't really the issue. It's the creators. And this is why I go back to artificial intelligence. It's the creators now of content of all kinds that are mad. Any artist you talk to, any working artist will say at some point their work's been stolen because an image got out there and somebody's using it. And it's really hard to govern that. And in the world of artificial intelligence, that becomes scraping of data. I don't know about you, but I'm starting to really see that sea change a lot of people predicted between the big tech companies going out and land grabbing data to now people who own data, not just rights holders in art, but lots of data, who say, no, this is changing. I'm going to control my own data. And there are a lot of companies emerging, from blockchain companies to other companies, that are going to make a lot of money by allowing people to control their own data. And we're one of them. And we're going to do that by standing up for creative rights holders' rights, knowing that, as I said, that marketplace exists already just because, you know, it has to by law.
But any piece of art that's had any kind of a history, there are layers upon layers upon layers of rights attached to this piece. And as I, you know, as I remember, copyright law, I guess because it goes back to the 1700s, 1600s, the penalties are incredibly stringent for copyright law. I mean, it's not like a slap on the wrist. These are proper penalties.
Really good point, Grant. I mean, in the United States, I think proven violation of a copyright can be as much as $250,000 fine and 3 years in jail. Now, the truth is, a lot of people say, well, but that's not really policed. You read about high-profile cases of copyright infringement and recent Prince and Warhol and cases that are well-known. But the reality is, it's because, and I think this is true in so many, maybe I'm just a purist or an optimist, but because it's mostly governed by good actors, people that want to do the right thing. And so if you look at everyone now in the art ecosystem institutionally, again, museums, auction houses, galleries, they're all doing this right. They know how important the image is to the creation of the object. And they're doing it right, but they're doing it with great difficulty. It's manual. As you say, the data may be there. Here's a good example. We hired our success lead from the Guggenheim a couple of years ago in New York, Kim Bush. And I remember saying to Kim, who's amazing, I said, so do you keep track when you do a big exhibition and you're taking in objects from other institutions and you're lending out for their exhibitions, do you keep records of rights holders? And she said, oh, absolutely. And we keep those up to date. But she said, they're in that file cabinet over there. And I said, are you willing to share it? And she said, absolutely. And all of her peers are, by the way, willing to share it because they know it'll help each other. So that's what you start to see, bringing greater transparency to information that is valuable to the art itself and is valuable to its past and its future, is a marketplace. Payment is happening between rights holders. For some, it's less important that they charge, but it's very, very important that they're given a permission or that they're asked for permission. For artists, that's the big thing. They just want to know that people know that that's theirs, you know, that they get the credit.
I totally understand that. I mean, I'm no artist, but when people ask me, hey, would you mind if I share this or share that? You know, I'm always delighted for them to do it. It's just nice to be asked, to your point. When we first talked, and this is going to delight an awful lot of people listening to this, I'm sure, I instantly thought, this is, finally, I can see something that is such a natural fit for blockchain is to be almost tailor-made for the technology. So how has blockchain being used in this, and what's blockchain's place in something like this? Because as I said, it just seems such a perfect way to illustrate the capabilities of blockchain to me.
Very well put and prescient of you to see that. And we are huge proponents and believers in blockchain. We actually started, when we started the company, we became students to the best of our ability of blockchain technology, its use cases. We wrote a white paper on it. If any of your listeners are interested in geeking out, they can't get to sleep one night. And what we discovered is there's no doubt, and a lot of the experts, both in the technology community and in the legal community who have become part of our inner circle, have said without question, our image licensing is a perfect use case for blockchain. And very simply, and I'm not a technologist, I'm a student of technology. And it's because of the point you made earlier, Grant, there are so many rights holders that to begin to have an indelible record, a chain, if you will, of those transactions, of those rights holders, just speeds up and makes more fluid, makes faster and more permanent the process of a trail of information around the object. So there's no question. Right now, it's in our future tech plans, not far off. We have a test planned just to prove not only the value of a blockchain incidence, a blockchain use case, but also to just see how it works, to, you know, for ourselves as a technology company. But the one thing that it requires, we learned, is connected data. So it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I'll relate this back to AI too. Connected data is vitally important to any technology like blockchain or artificial intelligence fulfilling its promise. Because without that information, without that connection between, as you said earlier, all of the history of where something moved, who has rights to it, who has gained rights to it, who is that rights holder. Once there's enough connected data, then a blockchain type solution becomes almost obvious. And similarly, had a very interesting conversation with a man from the Middle East recently, who's a technologist, who said that the promise of artificial intelligence in art is very limited in certain parts of the world without connected data. So if you start thinking about, for example, Islamic art, the Middle East, which is such an important part of the history of the culture, not as well known in the West, should be. We all should be seeing it and studying it and knowing about it. And without having those institutions and that data connected across the ecosystem, AI becomes not as powerful as it should be. So back to blockchain, no question, a big part of the future of managing rights. But the first task for us and the urgency is to get this database started, which we have, start to grow it, start to accelerate it. That takes resources, that takes investment, which we're working on. And eventually what happens is almost any person should be able to find an art object and know almost everything about it and know what they can and can't do with it. I always liken it to, what's fascinating to me is, let's say we liked a particular arcane TV show from the 60s in the US or the UK. You can literally find out a treasure trove of information about a walk-on actor from a database called IMDb. And IMDb was started a long time ago, and it's a fabulous business owned by Amazon and now used, as you know, from within their streaming, their own streaming
service. Yeah, I use it all the time, yeah.
It's very powerful, and such a capability doesn't yet exist in the art world. And some people will say, I should answer this, because you touched on it a bit, Grant, but some people say, well, why is that? And yes, there's been a history of the art world liking obscurity or liking the lack of transparency. But we see that changing, and we see it changing like so many things, you know, new generation of people that think differently. They see the value of transparency and information in access to things that can inspire people, that will make a difference in people's lives.
Yeah. Taking aside the physical art and the pictures of that physical art, let's talk a little bit about written art, particularly with reference to AI and large language models and data scraping and all the kind of stuff we've touched upon. Obviously, that's very different if you're an author, if you're someone who's putting stories out. And I read the article that you were talking about, you know, talking about the writers of fan fiction who are having their stories scraped and having new stories generated out. How do you manage these kind of chains with non kind of solid art?
The short answer to that is I'm not sure yet. But I know that because art is solid, is an interesting word, is a good place to start, because there's a specific reference to it, which is the image. And we haven't really explored this yet, but we're pretty sure that almost any form of digital content can pretty easily be assigned a digital record. And I think that's frankly where we're going to see in the not too distant future NFTs, for example, being not thought of only exclusively as a transaction technology, which is the way most of us think about it today, but rather as a tracking device. And whatever form that tracking device takes in an NFT, which there's lots of different ways to do that, I'm told, that means it could really be attached to almost any piece of content, a story, an article, a podcast of yours, and go on a ledger. And I think this is what I referred to, a really interesting New York Times article a minute ago last week, that really goes into how creators now are awake to this and really understanding the power of technology in tracking their work. It was so exciting to us to see that on the front page of the New York Times, because as you started this conversation, you said, wow, this is something I didn't know anything about, and I didn't either, and most people don't, but now a light's being shined, I guess, on this reality that content can be tracked in a positive way because people own it, have a right to it, and should be able to manage its use and get credit for that. And that's exciting. I mean, I love the world of creativity. I know you do. We met over an amazing presentation that you gave, which was one of the best stories about the world economy I've seen ever. And so as a fellow storyteller, to be able to see a world in which creativity becomes more trackable, more transparent, more accessible to more people, it's the best time for creators. It's scary, but there's a great future. I always think that, just as to add on to that, I always think, you know, museums are amazing places, and I'm always struck when I go to one and people line up. They line up to go in, and it's a wonderful, exciting, dynamic thing to see people walking around a museum. But what about the people that can't? What about people that don't? They don't live in a major metropolis where there's a phenomenal institution to walk into, even if there's a student pricing and it's not expensive, that they don't. And so those people need access, and the way they get access is through a digital channel. And without this tracking and without this permitting of use of images, so much of the world's art is stuck behind a wall. And by the way, very surprising to me, but it shouldn't have been, but only about 10% of any institution's collection is ever seen.
I was just going to bring that out. The access that this allows people to have for stuff that may not ever see the light of day. It just goes into the storeroom and, you know.
Right. And for the institutions. I mean, what's wonderful in this area is something I should have mentioned because it's so important to a lot of our partners. It's what's called open access. So it started with the Rijksmuseum. I think I might have mentioned this too when we met. And basically, what to define open access, it's identifying institutions, identifying what is in the public domain and literally putting it out in a digital form on a site that says you can use this. And that's great for a museum like the Rijksmuseum, where so much of their collection is in the public domain. But it kind of only takes you so far if you're an institution where the lion's share of your collection is not in the public domain, it's still protected. We want people to be able to see it. And it's in warehouses and it's behind closed doors. But a lot of these institutions, I mean, the Smithsonian, I'm told, is a great example of 24/7 digitizing a lot of the works in their collections, which means the positive intent of getting that out into the world, fulfilling their mission as cultural institutions is there. But then once it's digitized, how do I find it? It's very hard to find it unless it's on some kind of trackable shared ledger. So, just
coming back to AI, because this whole part of the puzzle fascinates me. This, the ability of AI to create images based on people's work, to create stories based on people's work. How does an artist protect themselves against that kind of threat? Because the inputs into, you could type into one of these AI engines and just say, you know, make me a painting in the style of Vincent van Gogh's Sunflowers. Is there any way to protect against that for content creators?
Probably not, is what we're learning. And I think it's a fair question. There is a thing, as you know, called fair use in copyright pretty much everywhere. And I think a lot of what will be generated by artificial intelligence could fall under fair use, but it's going to be challenged and it's already being challenged. And so to say that you can create something in the style of, it isn't the real thing. It isn't going to get credit as the real thing. And the latest US copyright office action says that it's not able to be copyrighted, so you can't protect it. So you kind of wonder, okay, I will be able to create something in the style of, I can put it out there. It's not the real thing, and it can't be protected. Oh, by the way, I should have said the reason it can't be protected, at least the current copyright expert opinion, and this I read recently is also true with patents in the US anyway, is because it has to have been created by a person. So you can't get copyright protection unless it was created by a person. I mean, that's still going to be debated. It is being debated. There are certain experts, obviously, some of whom may be listening to this podcast, that will say that's going to change. And that very well could be the case. But it still doesn't change the fact that an original piece of work by a creator or by a creator's estate or whoever's managing it doesn't require a license. And so that will only, I think, create more attention. So in a funny way, the more people do things in the style of something else, the more it calls attention to, here's the real thing. And if you want it, you need to get permission to use it. How do I do that? And right now, that's really hard, or if not impossible. So I think the way we should leave that is it's an interesting debate. I don't think there's any answers yet. But I, again, have a strong feeling that the more things are debated, the more they become important, the more transformation comes. And so that debate hopefully will lead to some good things.
Fantastic, which is such a fascinating story. I can't thank you enough for coming on and walking me through it again and hopefully introducing the whole subject to a whole bunch of people that, like me, were completely oblivious to the whole thing before meeting you. So for anybody out there who's interested in finding out more, tell them about CultureTech and where to find you and how to follow up and kind of all that good stuff.
And anybody that wants to find us either as a potential customer or just somebody that wants to debate the topic, we're also always looking for private investors that are interested in supporting an art tech kind of company. And it's richard.o'leary at culture.tech. Please feel free to email at our website, www.culture.tech. And really what our website's doing is showing the product, the initial product that we're launching with museums, with galleries, artists' estates, to really start this ball rolling. So that's really our focus, is we're all about being partners to these cultural institutions that have really opened up their arms to getting this kind of technology support and help. So anybody that's interested in that, please feel free to reach out to me. And by the way, I can't thank you enough, Grant, for your generosity. I've been listening to your podcast since we met, and they're fascinating to me. This may not be as fascinating as some of yours that I've heard, but I hope some will listen and like it and get something out of it. So
I have no doubt about that whatsoever. Richard, listen, again, thanks so much for your time, and hopefully our paths will cross again physically in the not too distant future.
I hope so. I look forward to it.
All right. Take care. Thanks again.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So interesting, all that. I know very, very little about the art world, as I said at the top of the show, but I was amazed at how dysfunctional it all seems to be. You know, there seems to be a clear digital solution for that, which offers a very obvious use case for blockchain technology. So I guess we'll see how all that pans out. But in the meantime, if you want to find out more about Richard and Culture Tech, the company's website, as he said, is culture.tech. And you can email Richard at richard.o'leary@culture.tech. That's it from me. I'll be back with another episode soon. In the meantime, as always, thank you so much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.